We're going to start just like a speaker.
Hi, everyone. My name is Juan. The only one. Just start off with thank you for you guys for putting all of this together. I've seen a lot of you guys put a lot of effort into making this happen, and I am very grateful for it. I'm so grateful to be here. I really needed it. I always need it, but this time it was like I need some self-care and I need to be in the middle of the herd. There's been challenges in my life and losses that I now know where to go to. It's one of the tools that I have in my life is just to come back to the herd, and that was not where I come from. So very grateful in so many ways. Thank you, Matt, for that great share. It was very inspiring. Wherever you are, I don't see you. It's always so inspiring to hear someone work through what they've gone through, and despite of all of that, and when I hear kids and a coupleship and work all of that, it's very inspiring. I need it. And a lot of you guys have been examples for me how to be a parent, and I need that really bad. I'll tell you guys a little bit of my story, where I came from, how and when I got here, and what it's been like since. I was born in Mexico City through a very large family. My early recollections, for the most part, pretty normal events. I remember learning how to ride a bicycle, a few bits here and there. I remember hearing that I had a very famous and big grandfather, and my dad was also a huge personality that everybody knew. And we lived in Mexico City for about 4 years, so my memories are very few. And then we moved back to Spain, to where my father is from. And there are a few more memories, and not a lot. I don't have a lot of early childhood memories, and for good reason, and you'll know it soon enough. Nothing that stood out in the early memories, but when I was about 8 years old, my dad had a very severe car accident. My dad was a famous soccer player in Spain, and he had lots of friends, bullfighters, and that soccer player, and that coach, and that. And he surrounded himself with all kinds with fast cars and all that. Well, in one of those fast cars, he just plowed into they went off the side of the road and had a pretty severe car accident that left him in a coma for about 6 months. Was never the same after that. And that's one of my earliest memories, is the shock of shit, what happened. And I remember going to, the few memories that I have is going out and seeing the car just burn to pieces, the crisp. And somehow they thought it was a good idea to give us the charred handlebar, the steering wheel. And it was very traumatic. And I don't have a lot of memories of all of that, but that I do remember. There were memories that came back after doing some work on program and grief work that came back. I remember the phone ringing and being very scared. I remember the fear. That's what I remember the most. The fear, and then suddenly the phone ringing, and it was somebody saying, "Ya salió, ya salió, ya salió. He's out, he's out, he's out." And I knew what that meant. He's out of a coma. And suddenly, and then that, the next memories after that, and it was all that the helping him to walk again, to ride, and he really messed him up. And from that moment on, that's when the shit hit the fan, That was a huge loss. And I remember he finally was able to walk, and I'd be who I was, running around like a madman. And I remember him just not being able to control me, and he fell to the ground and started crying, his eyes out. And this is from someone that had been an athlete for most of his life, and now he just couldn't. And I thought I broke him. And again, this has nothing to do with the disease, but this is one of my earliest memories. And I saw him do that, and that just, it just, wow, it terrified me that I somehow was guilty of having done something wrong with him. But shortly after that, I heard that we were moving back to Mexico, and that my dad needed to, he was gonna go to Casablanca and Melilla in Morocco, and he was gonna try to get better there. And he was like, okay, fine. And we're gonna go back to Mexico. And once we got to Mexico, we had a family that welcomed us, my grandfather and very large family in Mexico. My mom has 10 brothers and sisters. And then I remember asking about my dad, and he was like, just don't ask about him. Just, it was kind of, they let me on once, just don't ask. But I remember always questioning other people, and nobody talked about what about my dad? And I never saw him again. So that was a big, left a big impact on me. One of the memories that came back after doing some work in the steps was that of my dad, of me going with my mom and my sister, my younger sister, and we were going somewhere with my mom. And then my dad, and we were following a man, and then we went to this place, and my mom just told us to wait in the car, and then she went with the man, and turns out later I found out she was having an affair. Well, look, I put two and two together. That, oh, my mom is doing something that somehow I already knew that she shouldn't be doing. And I knew about it. My little sister didn't because she was much younger. But I knew this secret. And my mom never said, don't tell anybody. But I knew this was going on. And I kept it from my dad, and I kept it from anybody. And when I left Spain and we went back to Mexico, I didn't remember this memory. This is something that came out after doing some work in the program, and just memory started coming back from that traumatic period. But I remember that I had been carrying this tremendous shame. And the shame was that I thought that the reason why I never saw my dad, the reason why he abandoned us, is because I knew a secret, because I betrayed him by not telling him about my mom's affair. And so I started putting this picture together that I had this shame of carrying this secret, and I never told him. And so that's why he left. And so I started carrying that on. And that's the earliest memories was of that, with conflict and followed by loss. And then the shame of all of that, and feeling that somehow I did something wrong. After that incident, we settled down in Mexico. My mom, we got a lot of help from my grandparents. My grandfather was also a very well-known man in his field, and very charismatic, very generous, abusive, mentally, physical, emotionally, had a lot of those traits, some really wonderful traits and also some terrible ones, and did not drink. Was completely zero, none. Later on, I found out his father was an alcoholic and had abandoned them and had walked off. And so that was sort of the first sign that I knew was like, those are things that happen in our family, abandonment, emotional amputations, and all as a result of some conflict, and people disappeared. And so that began to sort of stay in my awareness. I went to school, a private school. We somehow, aunts managed to enroll us into a private school, and they got us some scholarships. And so we began to go to school. My mom got a job in the government. She barely made ends meet. She worked her ass off. We didn't really see my mom until late in the evening. It was four of us. I got two other brothers and a sister. There were four kids, and it was with a single mom. And it was a struggle. We got a lot of help from my grandfather, but my grandfather and my mom just did a lot of this. They were headbutting constantly. And I was that chosen child that I now know it was like I was the one that they could manipulate into this role of being the communicator. And from an early age, I was sort of fell into this role. I communicate to my grandfather for my mom, you know, or I would be the one that I would ask, you know, my grandfather, you know, for my Sunday allowance. And he would give me several hundred pesos every week. That's a lot of money for kids. So it meant to, you know, kind of came through my hand. And literally I would be there asking my grandfather, looking straight in the eye, and through this other door, there's my mom looking at me, making sure that I did the deed. And that was the role that I did, you know. I would communicate, and if there something happened, I was the one that had to go and tell him. And then if whatever he told me, I had to go tell her. And that was the role I started to play. It's that emotional incest. So that's what happened. You know, that's some of this stuff that started to happen. In that household with my grandparents and our own, there was a lot of physical violence. There was a lot of beatings because you deserved it. You know, you did this and it was a whooping, and that was, you know, that was normal. It was a religious family, a Catholic family. They all went to church every Sunday and communion and all of that. My mom did not believe in the church at all. She always told us, you know, you get to choose. You don't have to choose theirs, you could choose your own. But my grandparents did not want any of that, and the rest of the family would not have any of that. So they did whatever it could, and in that family, everybody got into everybody's business. And every, you know, it was a very large family of untreated Al-Anons. And there were a few alcoholics sprinkled throughout. You know, my crazy Uncle Domingo and Uncle Pablo. Yeah, but they were the funnest, actually. All the other ones were the crazy ones. Every Christmas, between, you know, Christmas and New Year's, it was like the Bermuda Triangle. Family members would disappear. They just weren't to be talked about again. My grandfather had a brother, Uncle Domingo. He was the guy that designed all the machines, and brilliant man. They had an argument, they had a conflict, and then never talked to about Domingo again. And you were not allowed to talk about it or go see him or any of that. So I got to witness some of those emotional amputations that go on. And that was, again, a trait that continued on in our family. Not only I had already seen it, I had heard it because of my great grandfather with my grandfather, that I had heard of it. But I had also now seen it with my own dad. That Sunday something happened, the accident happened. It was found out that my mom was having an affair. The shit hit the fan, boom, we got to Mexico and he disappeared, never saw him again. And there was other people. And so I'm telling you some things that, because those are all things that I also did later on in life. My mom did not take any kind of criticism well at all. My mom is undiagnosed bipolar borderline personality. And she had a hard life with, you know, she grew up in a well-off family in Mexico. That was never an issue, but it was a very dysfunctional family, and she had a lot of trauma with a very violent father that would become violent, and not a drinker at all. Again, did all of this sober. But I remember just how fearful I was of my grandfather. I was very fearful of my mother. I became to be the speaker and also the peacekeeper. And anytime I would sort of begin to read people, and anytime I sensed there were someone's running a little too hot, I'd make sure I go over there and sort of lower that temperature, do whatever distraction, whatever I had to do just to make that go away and try to control and my safety and be okay and avoid conflict at all cost. And I had already had experience with what happens when the shit hits the fan. My mom did not take criticism well at all. I remember a number of times going to, you know, I was not doing well in school. The teachers cared for me. And so they would call my mom through school and come and see them. And when, as soon as she heard your son is not doing good, I think she heard you're not doing good with him, she would just blow up and just create a scene. And then boom, you're out, you're going to another school. And so I'd go on to another school. So then there was another geographic move, and never saw my friends again. And same thing happened with her job. And if she had an issue with the job, boom, she's out of there, boom, we're gone. And this was an ongoing, it was something that was repeated multiple times in our childhood, having to move from job to job, and you know, because of, you know, somebody said something that she didn't care for, or some sort of a conflict, and we're off again to somewhere else. And this happened, you know, between schools and also in multiple schools. I went to about 9 schools between first grade and high school. And then that also turned into cities and countries, and we just kept moving. We became nomads. My mom did not get along with her father, and yet she needed him. And so I was always that one that I somehow had to take that role of communicating. My mom did like to drink here and there. I couldn't tell you if it was the alcohol or her bipolar disorder. It was just the ups and downs. And I learned to read when my mom arrived, the way the keys hit the table, that told you something. The way they, the speed and the force that they hit, the way the door closed, that one, the speed in which the car pulled up, and that also told you things. And I was very keen into all of that. And so were all my brothers and sister and my sister. We were just, oh shit, this is gonna be a bad one. And we get ready, and sure enough, you know, she might come in and just begin raging at us for, you know, and I know she had a hard time, but it was very scary for us. So we moved a lot. The family got involved constantly. You shouldn't be doing that, blah, blah, blah. Why don't you talk to your mom, and blah, 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 and lots of that. So it was, there was a lot of tension between the family members. So those are some of the things that I got to live with. I wrote down some of the things that really left an impression, and when I did my step work, my sponsor told me to focus on significant emotional events in my life. There was a loss, losses, multiple losses, you know, from my dad, friends, cousins, lots of losses there, and going from one to the other and just having to survive and never grieving any of it, just stuff it. And anytime I would ever say, well, what happened with my dad? Oh, they came down hard on me, my mom particularly, or my grandfather. My grandmother, she was a wonderful woman, but she would say, just don't bring it up, just don't make any waves. So I learned early on to avoid conflict, don't talk about those things. And I remember also being really shut down hard for speaking for myself. So I learned that it wasn't okay to ask for my needs or any of it. So I learned to be quiet. I remember my people, you know, somebody would be asking, he's like, wow, you guys are, you know, such cool kids or something like that. Somehow the conversation would end up, it's like, yeah, well, you know, your mom and dad really wanted to have your oldest brother, Jose. Yes, absolutely. And then came Santiago. Yes, two boys. And then you came. So then they had to try again and get a girl. And those were things that I heard, and they resonated from there. They stuck. It's like, oh. So I felt like I wasn't wanted. I was also, not only did I feel neglected, we were neglected. There were a lot of instances. And then with a single mom, how could you not? She wasn't there for a lot of our events. Nobody ever showed up to our games. My dad was gone, my mom was busy, grandparents, you know, there. So I always bragged about my father, you know, oh yeah, he's gonna come to the game this time. And he's like, no, I knew he wasn't, but I so desperately needed that. And there was nobody there for us. I remember being, once we wake up in the middle, in the morning, and I have to go to school, and somebody stole the on a Volkswagen bus that we had, somebody stole the mirror, because you could unscrew them, just twist them and they unscrewed, and my mom was pissed, and I'm just trying to figure out, and I see mom, there's another combi over there, another bus, and she's, go get their mirror. So she sends me over there, and I unscrew it, and I bring it in, and I screw it in, and I'm like, and that got us out of that, and it's like, and my mom's just like, good job. I remember, not too long after, I remember being in a shopping center, and, you know, somebody had given me a toy that needed batteries, and I'm thinking, well, I can't ask my mom, you know, but we couldn't afford batteries, just big giant D cells. I opened them up, stuck it in my pocket, and kind of five-finger discount, you call it. We get to the pocket, and we get to the car, and I pull it out, and I'm so proud. I'm going to show my mom. It's like, Mom, look what I stole. She went ballistic on me. She grabbed me by the ear, took me back into the store, and just humiliated me in front of the whole store. Just, and what I remember, it's like, fuck, you know, like this double standard that, you know, like it was so unfair. I just thought it was like, but I just stole the mirror, you know, what about this? And so suddenly I felt like, wow, this is, I can't do this. I was very confused, but I knew there was a different standard. It was like a... Other events later on in life, I remember my mom, you know, I loved airplanes. And I remember I saved all this money, whatever it cost, and I made this balsa plane, and it was my joy. And somehow I remember I just pissed off my mom, and she went ballistic, and she grabbed that thing and just destroyed it, just crunched it. And it was an instant, it was a significant emotional event in my life, because I remember that happened, and I was, I think, 9 years old or 10, that suddenly it's like, oh, fuck, I'm on my own. I remember distinctly me saying, I can't trust her. I can't. And that was sort of the beginning of that distrust. But yet, I still had to do my duty of getting money, asking my grandfather, somehow doing all this. So I did it. We eventually, my mom met, and we went to a trip to Acapulco. My mom spent her life savings. Finally, we get to go to Acapulco. We have a great vacation. She meets this gringo, this American guy at the trailer park, this big giant guy with a big beard, full stoner. He was such a stoner. And we walk into the camper, and we're all kind of like, what is that smell? And they're going, no, like the dog poop. That's what it is, just the dog poop. And they're like, but my mom just, you know, she was going out with this guy, and this guy just, convinced my mom that, yeah, let's go to the States. And we left on the Saturday. We came back from Acapulco, I think, on Monday. By Thursday, we had sold everything. We'd given everything up. And this is in the middle of the school year. And we're going to America. And I was just, what about my friends? Shut up! This is what we're doing. And, you know, and I started acting like, what about my friends? And what about my this and that? What about my uncles that are my age? They're like my brothers. No, we're taking off. So we packed up everything and we started driving, and we got to the border. And of course, we didn't have any papers. I don't know what she was thinking. So we get there, and he bailed once we got there. And he says, oh, you guys don't have papers. Well, don't know what to tell you. So he crossed the border and never saw him again. So we ended up in Tijuana, in the border for the next 4 years. We lived in hotels from one to the other, to the other, to the other. And then one day, my mom didn't show up, and we got concerned. And then the next day, a man came over and says, I'm a friend of such and such, one of your uncles. We're taking you back to Mexico City. So this is not after the 4 years, but this is during the first. 6 months that we had made it to the border, and it turns out that my mom had been paying fraudulently with credit cards and doing whatever she could to stay in all these hotels, and we eventually they caught her and threw her in jail. She went to prison for that, for embezzlement and or whatever the crime is. So we had this horrible, you know, terrible shame that now we're going back to Mexico, and this is just the stuff that happened. And again, the decisions that were made by my mom, it was like, who does that, you know? And so I now look at that and like, yeah, we were for those five, 6, 7 months that we were in there, we were homeless. We were just living either in the car or hotels to hotels. And it was never to the same one because we kept, you know, they kept catching on to her. So it was always a different one. And the grade of hotels kept going down and down till we were really running into some real shitholes in Tijuana. So we went back to Mexico City. We lived with my grandparents. They took care of us for the next year or so while my mom settled her problems and sorted all of that out. In my grandparents' house, I got to see a lot of, you know, again, there was a, from the outside, it was an amazing family with characters and, oh, amazing. But in the inside, it was just so chaotic, you know. There was so much infighting and a lot of dysfunctional behaviors, a lot of, you know, they said this, but then did this. And so we got to be there, and we were, by then, we were really keeping quiet and don't make any waves because it could be us next. It's, so again, more conflict, and boom, people disappear. After that year, we eventually made it back to meet with my mom, and now we lived in Mexicali. And we were there for about 2 years, two very hot years. Mexicali is, that's a hot place. It makes Palm Springs look like a resort. Well, it is a resort. Mexicali is not. I went to another school there. So by that time, I had already lost, I think, a year and a half worth of schooling. So now I don't remember what years they were. So another school, another town. Eventually, we moved back to Tijuana. We find a place, it was like a slightly better place. It was by the beach. It was like stone distance from the actual border. And it was not a big part of town, but another year of school. I didn't fit in. I had never fit in. And that's another part of my story that I guess it's indirectly connected to the dysfunctions of what this disease does and the decisions that are made by our parents. When I lived in Mexico, when we moved to Spain, I didn't speak like a Spaniard. I didn't have the accent. So I remember everybody making fun of us, like, yeah, you guys are funny, you know. You know, you don't speak like us. And I remember being aware that I was different. We moved from Spain back to Mexico. By then, now I speak like a Spaniard. I go back to Mexico and they make fun of us because now you speak like a Spaniard. So then I feel like I don't fit in. We moved to the north and we're blonde, you know, we're not necessarily the typical Mexican looking. We're Spanish blood. And so we're a white guy, we're a güero. So they look at us and say, you're not from around here. Where are you from? You're not gringo and you're not Mexican. What are you? And again, everywhere I go, I feel like I don't fit in. So not only do I feel like, you know, I felt neglected and I felt I was treated differently. It felt like they didn't really want me in the first place. I started to put this picture together that I just wasn't enough. That's where the impact of this disease had on me. We came to the U.S. I came in as the son of somebody else. There was an American couple that was willing to help us. And then we came to the border and they said, we're U.S. citizen. And they said, and then they looked at me and I had learned to say I'm a U.S. citizen. I didn't speak English, but I learned how to say that, U.S. citizen. And all my brothers and sisters learned how to say anything. And we, one by one, they got us in as if that we were their own. My mom did have to jump the fence and go her route. And eventually we met up in San Diego and we lived there for about 2 years. I did one half of 1 year of school and the other half of the other year. But again, I never finished any of my traditional schooling. So again, more moving, more, a lot of crazy stuff. I think if I left anything out, that's of significance. Talked about the loss, the abandonment, the shame, the fear and uncertainty. Those are all very powerful feelings that I had. The neglect, the enmeshment, codependency, the low self-esteem, avoiding conflict at all cost, the unmanageability, and all of that was normal to us. We didn't know any different. Moving forward some years, I could never ask a girl out, never knew how. I was a good looking boy. But so that only got me into the front door, and that was it. After that, I would just freeze and tumble and could not go any further. I could make him like me, but I couldn't go, and I just didn't have the skills for that. So through what would have been, I guess, high school and those first years of, you know, later teens and then into my 20s, every relationship that I had was always with an unavailable woman. Every single one, not one was not. They were either married or had a boyfriend or something with that, but they really were not, and they're emotionally available. But yet somehow that's what I ended up with, and it was, and they're the ones that picked me. And I felt that, like, I don't care who you are, what you are, but they, but if you, if only you pick me, I'm in. And that's what I did. When I was 19, I met this gal who really was just had her act together. She was 9 years older than me. That was no flag to me in any way. That was, I painted every red flag I had a green marker for, every one of them. This one, she really was a good person, but I remember thinking, like, oh, she's 9 years older than me, and this one, I'm 19. So that was a big eight, but she likes me. And so I was all in. And we had, actually, we had a very good relationship. She was that stability that I never had growing up. We were together for 17 years. We did a lot of things together. It was fantastic for many years. But there did come a point to where my issues began to really get in between us. I was dishonest because I never really shared what I felt with her. There were times where I felt like, you know, our age difference was, it was generational, just about. At that age, it was. But I never shared with her. I just thought that if I ever tell her what I truly feel, I will break her heart. And she would always tell me that she was so in love with me. And I was in love with her as much as I was capable of being in love with anybody. After all the losses in my life, you were gonna go as deep as as anybody was gonna get, which was pretty thin, in, you know, you were not gonna get in deep. I had made sure that I had a crocodile skin when it came to that kind of stuff, for protection. And so I never wanted to tell her, you know, that when I was starting to feel unhappy and also my own issues started getting in the way, I did not open up to her and tell her what I felt. I just continued on, and I figured that all I had to do is what I had always done, which is stuff it. Stuff the feelings, they'll go away. And they did. Eventually they would resurface again, and I'd do the same thing. At about year 15 or so with her, I remember telling her that I didn't have the courage to tell her that I wasn't happy with us. I just said that we need a change. We need to make changes. And she was willing to But I was like, damn it, she didn't quite get it. And I was also very vague. I never was there direct. I just had to, again, that childhood communication I learned, it was always kind of go around and take a long way, and just, I was very vague. And so what ended up happening is I just started we thought we had a really good relationship because we never had a fight. Of course not. I always avoided all conflict at all cost. And I took blame for everything. If there was anything that wasn't working, I took the blame. And I said, I'm not sorry about that. I kept taking everything on as if it was my fault. And eventually that relationship, it really came to an end. It just, I'm 100% responsible for my 50% of that relationship, but I did a lot to damage it. I did a lot of damage to her. I really hurt her. I broke her heart, and she did not deserve it. And that was me. I had other, even before her, I had other relationships with other people that were so completely inappropriate, and I hurt them so bad, and I have to own that. Some I hope people never find out about it, and my amends to them is just that I hope I never do it again, period. And I hope that they never find out what I did that could really, really hurt them. But that's just, again, that's just who I was. I thought I could end this relationship after 17 years, and all I had to do is like, okay, I have to tell her that I'm not happy, then it's gotta be followed by, I think I might be moving out, then move out and do all these things, and then, okay, it's done. How does long does that take? Maybe a month and a half, 2 months? And this is in my mind, this is what I'm thinking, and thinking that I could deal with 17 years of relationship and I can amputate those feelings off like I had done with all these other relationships. So my relationship was going down, and I started to, that's when I really started to get into a lot of pain, and really I started to, my life was really starting to get very unmanageable. My best friend at the time, he'd been my best friend for a good 7-8 years, and we had a lot in common, we had a business together, committed suicide. He hung himself. And that was a punch in the gut. And I cried for about 5 minutes. And I just stuffed it. And I didn't know how to process that. But it started to, I cried and I just, but it just, now the pressure is really building. And then out of nowhere, for one thing or another, I find out that my dad, we've reconnected with my dad. My brother has made contact with him, and he would love to see us. And so now suddenly my dad is in the picture after 30 years, and he wants to meet us, and all. And this is now, this is just too much. And that's when my life had become so unmanageable in so many ways. My lying, my chronic lying, my manipulation, my deceit, my constantly pleasing people, that's what I did all the time. I've so relied on what my career was, which is pretty cool. I did some pretty cool things, but my whole identity was based on what I did. And if I wasn't doing that, then who the hell am I, you know? I never thought that just me was enough. I had to be doing something to get your approval. And I so desperately need your approval that I will do whatever. And if I made a roller coaster just to prove you that I'm a pretty clever guy, as soon as that roller coaster's done and you turn away and it's like, oh fuck, I now gotta build something bigger because it was just a constant chasing of that approval because I just didn't feel like I was enough. So that's when my life really became unmanageable. I went to a therapist and began to open up that can just a little bit. My sister, who had been in program for a couple of years now in Al-Anon, has suggested to me that that I could, that, you know, that this program was working for her. And I looked at that, it's like, but I don't see where this alcoholic is. We don't have an alcoholic. It wasn't clear to me that our family had been affected by someone else's alcoholism, even though it was two generations down. But our family had major, you know, Al-Anonic dysfunctions. Is that our, what's my time?
7 minutes.
Wow, that went fast. So that's what got me into program. I finally came in, went to two meetings, and then I went to, one of the guys suggested I go to an offsite about 17 years ago now. And I met some of you guys here. And you guys introduced me to the 12 steps, which I had never heard of. I had heard of AA, but 12 steps, oh, they did those. Anyway, I was in so much pain and I wanted some relief. So I began to, I got a sponsor that same weekend, who's still my sponsor, Jack. And he said, if you want what, and he asked me, what, you know, I said, I want what you guys have. He says, well, if you want what we have, you should consider doing what we had to do. And that was get a sponsor, work the steps, and stay in the program. So I began that process. It didn't take me long to work the first two steps. The word God, I did not care for. The examples I had by the religion that I grew up with were not very good. But I did have a higher power that I did trust, and that was, to me, it was in nature. I always felt safe in nature. I had always relied on that, even for the things that I was neglecting, and said, yeah, that'll fix it. And all I was doing is just neglecting things, and neglect meaning even myself. But what I learned in here was that I began to see that it had worked for you guys, and maybe that I should perhaps do what you guys have done. And you guys became my higher power. I have two higher powers. I have nature and evolution and what's out there, and it's applicable in many areas. But it won't fix a lot of what the challenges that I ended up with. That I've needed that direct, I need to hear it from you guys. I need to, the examples, how to be a better person. The parents in this group, La Cañada has always had babysitting. Thank God for that. We don't have it right now, but hopefully we will. When I had kids, when my kids came along and I started a relationship in the midst of ending that one relationship, I met an amazing woman, and that we came into program together, and then we both took on our own journey on through that. And through all of that, and as messy as it was, we made it work. I worked all the steps in Al-Anon. Took me a long time to work the fourth step. I had an amazing sponsor that gave me clarity and a different perspective when I shared it with him in my fifth step. And that was key for me. I had a lot of things that I had not seen, and he pointed it out to me. Eventually, I got to really see where all my, I don't like to call my character defects. I'll say it right now. Once it is said, they are our character defects. What I look at him now is, those are behaviors that no longer work for me. All those things that I did that brought me into program, they were also the skills that allowed me to survive growing up. And if it hadn't been for that, I don't know what would have happened. So I need to, part of that, I need to recognize why I have them and why I go to them every so often when I react. But they no longer work in my life today, not as a married man, not in the work that I do, nor do I want it. It's just made my life so difficult. And as a parent, I don't want to repeat what was done in our family. It was generations. I don't want to take off. You guys have shown me how to be a better dad, what are the different options that I have, how to communicate with them, how to work a partnership. I did not have very good examples of parents. But in my fourth step and my fifth step, I got to see that I was affected as well as in that area and in other areas. So I've joined other programs. I work a program with my wife for RCA, for Recovering Couples Anonymous, and it's just been a godsend because we both have all kinds of issues that get in the way of the us. We have a higher power together, and that's my principles and my values, and she has her principles and values, and when we bring them together, we now have this higher power, and we now use it to allow us not to be such adversaries, because we can get that way. Our issues get in the way. The big stuff outside doesn't affect us as much. It's the little stuff, our family of origin stuff, that gets in the way. And as a result of all this work, it's, you know, my life is to say that it's amazing, or that it's incredibly beyond what I ever imagined, is an understatement. Not to say that it's full of challenges. There's all kinds of challenges. I'm still overcoming lots of isms, fear, and that self-worth. Oh, every day I have to take that 10th step, which is make an amends as quickly as possible. Well, a lot of those is that I keep thinking that I'm not enough, and I have to amend that behavior. No, I am enough. And I have to start again from that very core, I'm enough. I will be okay, and then work my way out of that. And I would not be able to have done any of that without the guidance from you guys. And what I have today, the things that I play in my life that are incredibly important today is gratitude. It's a huge one. I didn't have that. I couldn't see that before, and I do today. Compassion, that's another one, big one. For me, for those around me, and the tools that I have available at my disposal. I know my parents did the best that they could with what they had and with what they were willing to do. I'm doing the best that I can today with what I have and what I'm willing to do, and I'm willing to look at the shit that I still need to work on, and I choose to work on that as imperfectly as I can, but it's been worth it. It's been absolutely worth it. Again, I came in for relief, and what I've gotten is a life. I had no idea that was going to happen. I just wanted the pain to go away. That's all I wanted. And now it's just the promises, yeah. I think every single one has come through. So I wish I could have spoken more about recovery, not drug on too much on the old stuff. Jack C. told me once, is either way you're going to help somebody, you're either going to be a loud warning or an inspiration. So either way, I might help somebody. So anyway, thank you guys, and I love you.